Veronica wants to have an experience with a guy and a girl with a strap-on. I'm going to be the girl with a strap-on, and if you want, you can be the guy. I stand there with my jaw open. I'm completely speechless. I thought I understood life. I thought I understood women. I thought I was at least starting to understand myself. Clearly, I know nothing. And then Belle asks Veronica, "Is it okay if I fuck you with a strap-on?" And Veronica, in her sharp Czech accent, says, "I would prefer not." Okay, that's more like it. One of the girls just poured cold water over the other's hopes and fantasies. Evidently, I do understand how things work after all. "Let Belle fuck you with a strap-on, for Christ's sake," I tell her, in the spirit of communal living. She's not amused. The three of us finish dinner in silence. I've really outdone myself with this relationship. Rather than making one person miserable, like my father made my mother, I've made three women miserable. Afterward, I hear Anne walking up the stairs. I hide in the bathroom. Emotionally, I'm 8 years old right now, but I don't want to look at her. It's like staring into a vortex of guilt, which keeps howling. "You're hurting me by not reciprocating my totally irrational love for you." There's a light tap on the bathroom door. She's found me. If only I could flush myself down the toilet and escape through the sewers of San Francisco. I'd rather see 3-foot rats with razor-sharp teeth dripping with meningitis than face a woman I've hurt. But of course, I let her in, because the only thing sharper than those rat teeth is guilt. I return to my errant king's throne. She sits on the floor in front of me and says the dreaded 3 brain-eating words. "Can we talk?" "Sure. I'm happier speaking again. But before you say anything, just know that I'm this close, pinching my thumb and index fingers almost together, to losing it. I can either go home tomorrow or stay here for the rest of the time," she says. "But if I stay, I expect quality time with you, and I need everyone here to be respectful of my feelings." She looks at me hopefully, waiting to see how I'll respond to this request that she's clearly put a lot of time into properly formulating. And so I give her, sweet, suffering Anne, a piece of my mind. "I think you've been really selfish. You say other people here aren't being respectful of your feelings, but have you been respectful of theirs? You say they can't touch me, but then you get to touch me. I think you came here with your own agenda and completely ignored what this living situation was all about." She doesn't immediately respond, of course. Her lower lip juts out, and she hangs her head, and her face puffs, and drops of water peel off her eyes. Eventually, the words dribble out. "So what do you want me to do?" "Nothing. But just know, if you stay, that I can't be affectionate with anyone. I can't hold anyone's hand, I can't kiss anyone, and I can't sleep with anyone." Man, monogamy was better than this. In Muslim countries where polygamy is allowed, some advocates say that it keeps husbands from having affairs. I used to think that this was just sophistry, but I now know it to be true. Because any normal person with 3 or 4 wives is going to be too busy and emotionally exhausted even to consider adding another woman to the mix. Anne stares at me sympathetically. Then she says, "This can be a growing experience, and we can become wise from these experiences." "Well," I tell her, "I've definitely learned a lot from it." "I want you to know something," she continues. For the next few minutes, she shares her timeline. Her father abandoned the family for a gay lover. Her mother went crazy afterward. Her uncle was an alcoholic. Her first boyfriend raped her. Then she concludes, "You hurt me more than you can comprehend." "I didn't know all that," I tell her. My guilt is flowering again. I can't believe I've been put on that list of horrible traumatizers. Though now I understand why she hides beneath all that unflattering clothing. It's not unlike the sexual anorexic from rehab hiding behind her weight. I don't think I'm healthy for you, I tell her. But maybe this had to happen so you could be in reality about who I am and not in romantic fantasy anymore. And then what does she do? Does she leave? Does she get over it? No. She puts her hand over mine and drops her head gently into my lap. We've just gone through the entire love-avoidant, love-addict relationship cycle that Ingrid and I experienced, and I only met Anne a month ago. It's accelerated dysfunction for the information age. Anne wanted her one true lover. I wanted my poly partner. We both struck out. In the dance of infatuation, we see others not as they are, but as a projection of who we want them to be. And we impose on them all the imaginary criteria we think will fill the void in our hearts. But in the end, this strategy leads only to suffering. It's not a relationship when the other person is completely left out of it. I'm sorry about the situation, she says. If you want me to stay, say it. Please be sure you're in my heart whatever happens. Everybody can make mistakes. And just so you know, I forgive you. The heart of a woman is a beautiful thing. I'm ashamed by my previous words and behavior. That means a lot, I tell her. Let's just go to sleep and take some alone time to process everything that happened tonight, and we'll talk more in the morning. Anne doesn't respond. Instead, she just lies in my lap content, like Hercules, and I fall asleep on the toilet like the piece of shit I am. Chapter 37. At some indeterminate hour of the night, I stumble out of the bathroom and make my way to the couch. A dream still lingers in the fog of my brain. I was driving a new car, but I lost control and smashed it into a wall. I pull the sheet over myself and set the alarm on my phone for noon. I have a call to make to Hawaii, to Isis Aquarian, one of Father Yod's wives. I wake up shivering and wash my face with warm water, then call Isis and tell her I'm a fan. I'm not sure what that means, but she seems happy to hear it. So I let her know how I got her phone number by contacting the editor of the book on Father Yod and explain my current situation. It's not easy, she agrees. After Father died and the family dispersed, no one was able to make it work with multiple partners. I press her for an hour with every question I can come up with about life with Father Yod and what made it work then. She tells me that Father Yod was previously in traditional marriages. He started a vegetarian restaurant and a commune called The Source with his fourth wife, and the group eventually grew to 200 people living together. Soon after, he realized that the rules of his relationship had to change. He'd been giving hints, Isis explains, but Robin, his actual wife, kept getting dramatic and freaking out. She started hanging on him all the time and following him around because she knew it was going to happen. And then one day, he just announced he was going to have extra women. It was his journey and he was the boss, but he was a very benevolent boss. It's odd. She describes him almost the exact same way Kamala Devi described herself, as a benevolent authoritarian. I feel for his legal wife, the love addict whose heart he had to break in order to live his poly dream. But at least he was honest with her. I imagine that most men would do something similar if they became a virtual god to a community of free-spirited women. What made the ensuing group relationship successful, Isis explains, is that unlike my situation, the women had already been living together in the community, so they were connected and bonded with one another in advance. In addition, Many had come from ashrams, intentional communities, and hippie lifestyles where they were used to more communal relationships. So the wives all got along, except, of course, for his legal wife, who wasn't happy with any of this. Was there any kind of hierarchy among the wives, I ask? Was one of them his primary? No, she replies. We each had our own specific role. Makushla was his mother angel and took on a mother role. I had his back as his bulldog and the archivist saving his legacy. Others had the role of having his child. We all had our role, and within that position, we were the primary. Now, for the most awkward question. How did the sex part work? Was it all together, or one at a time? Or what? Isis tells me the wives never had sex with each other, only one-on-one with him. She goes on to explain that he chose each of his wives because he believed he had karma from a previous lifetime with them to resolve. Some of the women, Isis elaborates, were 16, but they had past lifetime threads with him. Evidently, the Achilles heel of cult leaders is that they think they're above the law. It's disturbing how as soon as they reach the pinnacle of their power, one of the first things so many choose to do is sleep with and often control the development of underage girls. Even one of Muhammad's wives was a preteen. Of course, Isis continues, every woman in the family wanted to be with him, but he coupled many of them with other people they had karma with, so other men had multiple wives also. And you never fought about who got the front seat in the car? That never happened, because we were living as spiritual beings, not in our animal energy. Apparently, Father Yod did exactly what Orpheus Black recommended to me, and what I didn't do with my quad. He instilled his partners with a strong sense of family and of the future. In Father Yod's case, it was the belief that they were following an earthly god and ushering in a new era of humanity in which they and their children would be prophets of the coming Aquarian age. As a result, few people wanted to leave this exalted sanctum. It also helped that they donated all their money and property when they came to live with him, so they were pretty much stuck. As I continue talking with Isis, I understand that what it takes to enjoy being the fulcrum is a high degree of narcissism and an unwavering certainty that your needs and beliefs are more important and enlightened than those of the rest of your community and quite possibly the world. Much to my dismay, as this picture emerges, I see that Father Yod may be more a model of what to avoid than to emulate. He demanded everyone's worldly goods, rigorously controlled his followers, and put their lives and their children's lives in jeopardy by not allowing them to use medicine because of his spiritual beliefs. And this, sadly, may be the norm. In fact, most of the communes known historically as sexually liberal were actually very strict on the matter. At Oneida, a 19th century utopian community that considered monogamy a sin, a committee approved hookups to make sure people weren't coupling off, and men were forbidden from having orgasms during intercourse without authorization. Similarly, the Carista commune in San Francisco, where terms like compersion and polyfidelity were invented in the 70s, was another group run by a narcissist with strict rules, which included forbidding members from masturbating or having group sex. When he flew off the cliff, he was done and ready to move on, Isis says, referring to the hang gliding accident that killed Father Yod. And he left us because we wouldn't let go of him. However, to this day, I've kept my thread with him. I'm still his woman. I haven't been with anyone else. I'm astounded by her dedication. He died 4 decades ago. I wonder if she also fits the love addict template, and if ultimately Father Yod, whose pseudonym is clearly a magnet for abandoned women, felt so consumed by the pressure of being the fulcrum for so many people that he eliminated himself. Do you have any final words of advice for anyone doing something similar now? I ask. It made sense in the time frame of the 60s and the 70s, she replies. But now I think it's a foreign thing. If you brought a woman into that situation today, I don't think it would work. Good luck, sweetie. So that's it? Just good luck attempting to pull off the impossible? I hang up and look for more case studies online. In Hebrew, the word for co-wives is tsara, which tellingly also translates as rival. And in ancient Egypt, second wives were called isirtu, which means rival as well. In Spanish, the word for wives, esposas, also means handcuffs. Even Muhammad's wives were jealous. Stories of them smashing dishes, conspiring against a favorite wife, and gossiping about one another abound. And then there's the Mormon prophet Brigham Young, who, like Father Yod, opened up his monogamous marriage soon after he felt a religious calling, except that he took on an astonishing 53 additional spouses. And they were almost the death of him. At one point, he told his wives to leave if they weren't happy, proclaiming, "I will go into heaven alone rather than have you all scratching and fighting around me." As I read more about history's great fulcrums, which differ greatly from what I fear was an immature fantasy, I hear Belle talking to Anne in the living room. "Do you want to sleep with Neil?" Belle asks. "Yes," Anne tenderly replies. "If you don't let us have sex with him, then you can't have sex with him. It's not fair for you to want to keep him for yourself." At least Belle and Anne are taking Pepper's advice and working things out among themselves. Still, it's weird to hear them negotiating and manipulating to sleep with me as though I were some kind of prize. Perhaps Isis is still faithful to Father Yod, not just because of the depth of her love for him, but also because she's still trying to win, to prove that she's the best wife. I wonder why, after I completely fucked her over last night, Anne would still want to sleep with me. Or maybe that is the reason. Being fucked over is what she's used to. As long as she, like Isis today, is in love with someone who can't reciprocate, she may always be sad, but her heart will always be safe, because no one can ever truly get to it. Perhaps what I need to do is accept rivalry as an expected part of any group relationship, then learn how to best manage it. So before venturing into the zombie lair, I decide to call one last person, Orpheus Black. He's figured out how to make a group marriage work in the modern world. He'll know how to handle the competitiveness. "It's actually just Indigo and me right now," he responds when I ask for advice. "What's happened to the rest of your wives?" "We're separated." He speaks these two words as if they're a confession of regret, vulnerability, failure. I can relate. "What happened to family and the future?" Someone stabbed it in the back. After some prodding, he tells me that one of their former lovers spread rumors about him and manipulated his wives against him. The venom rotted the group and harmony turned to drama, so he decided to let his two non-legal wives go. Immediately afterward, as a result of the stress and strain, he woke up one morning with amnesia. Not only could he not remember a thing that had happened, but he couldn't even recognize his actual wife, Indigo. This lasted 2 weeks. Though he tells me he plans to rebuild his family again, I feel vindicated that even Orpheus, with all his experience and confidence, couldn't keep three women together and stay sane. Clearly, being a fulcrum is not easy, even for very experienced people. Chapter 38. When everyone's awake and dressed, we take our usual places in the living room for a much-needed house meeting. I have a lot of apologizing to do. But before I can speak, Anne beats me to it. "I'd like to say something," she begins. "I made a mistake." "What mistake is that?" I ask. "I want to stay. I promise to share things." She glances at Belle, who nods her approval. "I'm willing to share you." "Yes, I want to stay. One thing about polyamory is that it's never dull or predictable. Belle's negotiation was evidently a success. You manipulated her, Veronica cuts in, glaring at Belle. It's not fair to do that to Anne, just so we can sleep with Neil. If you'd asked any of them a month ago what they'd do in this exact situation, every one probably would have said she'd leave and never speak to me again. Yet here they are, breaking every law of logic, self-respect, and common sense. And perhaps it's a dynamic I set up by Svengalying these smitten women into playing a role in my sick fantasy. I look at the strength in Veronica's eyes, the desire in Belle's, and the hope in Anne's, and I feel, for the first time since we arrived, completely clear-headed. Since last night, I've written, rested, and talked to Isis and Orpheus. Now is the time to make a powerful decision. Father Yod made things work by not asking for or needing anyone's permission to set the rules for the family. Same with Hugh Hefner, same with Oneida and Carista and Orpheus Black. Everyone was subservient to the mission and the word of the benevolent dictator in charge. If someone didn't like the rules, they were presumably free to leave. So all I have to do is lay down the law, and that's how things will be going forward. But I'm not Father Yod. I'm not Hugh Hefner. I'm not even Orpheus Black. And after what I've learned this week, I don't think I'd ever want to be them. I'm done with my Father Yod fantasies. There's only one right thing to do. Here's what I think, I tell Anne. You very well could just suck it up and share me, but you'd be harming your spirit if you did. That wouldn't be true to who you are. She looks into my eyes imploringly. I think I can handle it. You can handle the hurt and the pain? Is that what you're saying? Yes, some things are more important. She speaks quietly, her body rigid but quivering, as if about to collapse into the black hole of itself. I don't want you to be a martyr. You tried that last night, and look what happened. It's time to do what's best for Anne. And if you were to ask me what I think is best for Anne, it would probably be best that she goes home. But I can change, she protests, steeling her nerves, summoning her power. I can work on controlling my emotions. If you had a daughter, I ask, and she was in the same situation, would you tell her to try to control her emotions or to trust them? She thinks about it for a moment, then says softly, without the bravado of earlier, to trust her emotions. Then why don't you take your mother's advice? You're a healer, and you spend a lot of time healing other people, but maybe it's time to start healing yourself. I suddenly realize that those feelings of hatred I had for Anne the night before weren't actually about her at all. They were about my mother. And when Anne looks at me with those loving eyes, she's not Stalin trying to send me to an emotional gulag or a zombie trying to eat my brains. She just loves me. Whether rightly or wrongly, it doesn't matter. It's just love. That's it. Nothing to be afraid of. The whole time I've been living with these three, I've seen love as a demand. I need to talk to you. Don't text when you're with me. Tell her to order food for me. Don't hold anyone else's hand. It's not fair. My turn to sit in the front seat. I've seen love as a padded cell designed to take away my freedom. And that's because my long-suffering mother used love to exert control over me, which she enforced with guilt. In my relationship with Ingrid, I think as I sit illuminated by the beams of six expectant eyes, I interpreted her love as control and resisted it. First through cheating, and when that got shut down, through resentment, fantasizing, and emotional distancing. My whole life, I've been fighting against love for my freedom. No wonder I've never been married, engaged, or even had a love that didn't wane after the initial infatuation period. It's a depressing realization, I wonder why I'm just figuring it out now. Maybe I needed a situation this intense and overwhelming to force it to the surface. I take a deep, reed-like breath and look Anne in the eyes without resistance for the first time in days. And I apologize sincerely for my behavior. I'd like to make amends for what happened yesterday, I tell her. There's a process I recently went through called chair work, and it helps people get the bad things that happen to them out of their body and their psyche. I can sign you up for that and help pay for it if you need me to, because whatever happened to you in the past, you should have professionals helping you treat it. Gazing into her eyes, without fear of my own annihilation, I notice a beautiful, loving, gentle soul looking back at me. A woman who's gone through hell and miraculously managed to keep her heart pure. And I feel bad for not seeing her as she is, but through my own distorted, reactionary lens. I should have behaved like this the whole time and seen the beauty in each of my partners instead of the flaws, empathized with their needs rather than feeling trapped by them. And I most definitely should have done this with Ingrid instead of regressing every time she got too close. But don't you want me to stay so you can see if this type of relationship can work for you? Anne asks. Now suddenly she gets what all this has been about. Apparently, being understood leads to understanding. Honestly, I tell her, my work is done. I'm sucked dry. I just don't have the constitution for a relationship like this. I don't think it would ever work for me with anybody. I guess I've got my answer. Now what do I do? Chapter 39. Excerpt from Anne's journal.
This week was my first time to the U.S. It was an adventure. Something new with much unknown. And for the first time, the unknown was not scary to me. My deep intuition was that it would bring me really important things. I told Neil I wanted to be an experienced woman, but at the time had only a vague idea of how. I knew I wanted sex. And I was thinking about having new experiences, for instance, being with another woman. But when I arrived, I became afraid of being hurt and losing my self-esteem. And I didn't feel that breaking my boundaries would be a good idea. Will I be ready one day to break some of them? I don't know. I think I need time and a reassuring and respectful context to be able to disinhibit. Though I know if we had a normal relationship, it would have bored me and would have not been an effective way to evolve. I could tell on my first date that there were many differences between us four that created some misunderstanding, seeing everybody touching, stroking, and whatever was weird to me. It felt like I'd landed on another planet. It was not the kind of relationship I imagined we would be having. Before I came, he told me there was something like that happening, but I didn't let my inner voice prepare me. During our time together, we had to make choices. We hesitated and didn't always know what was best for us. A great lesson this taught me was that if we place ourselves in our hearts to make choices in new situations, we can't make any mistakes. I think that one of the most important things I became aware of through this experience is what it means to be a woman. Neil told me to listen to my heart and inner feelings. He had an insightful remark that was like, if it was your daughter, what would you tell her to do? Behave with yourself as if you were your own mother. I had a dream 5 years ago in which my boyfriend at the time gave me half of a moon. After that, I left him to go to a room where a mature man with a shaved head and a dark beard was waiting on a big red bed. I met him and he gave me the second half of the moon. I know now what that dream means. The moon symbolizes the woman and the mother. And now I can say that the man on the bed was Neil. even if I didn't know him at that time. So, thanks to this experience and to Neil's advice, I finally understand and feel what being a woman is to become my own mother. I definitely feel the change. Since I now consider myself my own mother, I don't need to mother others anymore. I can now be in a relationship without trying to help someone. They can father themselves. We laughed a lot in the last hours we spent together. I offered to do acupuncture on everyone, and I was glad to see that it comforted all of us. And then we were finally at peace together. When he dropped me off at the airport, Neil told me that he was worried we had wasted our time. And I answered that there was no wasted time, but just time. And time is useful to experience and grow. This unusual relationship was a great thing to confront my issues, to know myself better and to help me change. I can truly say it brought me a lot more than a normal one would have.
Chapter 40. Formerly proud and erect, it has gone limp. Where once it was bursting with vitality, it now looks brown and lifeless. The survivor is not surviving very well in my care. I can't let Ingrid's indestructible plant die. I have to at least be able to take care of something successfully. As soon as I return home from San Francisco and see the neglected state it's in, I water it, move it into direct sunlight, and rush out to buy vitamin-enriched soil for it. While I'm out, I check in with some of the guys from rehab. After reaching his 18th month of involuntary celibacy, Adam decided to contact Lorraine for additional counseling. Charles is separated and living in a motel, and Calvin tells me that things have been a disaster since he brought Mariana and his son to L.A. She's been depressed and misses Brazil, and he's been angry because he feels trapped and forced into the relationship by the child. Mariana wants to go back to Brazil, and I haven't been trying to discourage her, he confesses. But I'm going to miss Flavio. Looking into the innocent eyes of your own child in the morning and seeing a big smile spread across his face is sublime. I hope you get to experience it one day. I hope so too, I tell him. I don't think I've ever felt that kind of joy. While Calvin's predicament was foreseeable, Troy's current situation no one saw coming. Not only did he start seeing his affair partner again, but she wants him to be monogamous with her. She wants you to break up with your wife? I ask Troy to clarify. No, she knows I can't do that. She just doesn't want me having sex with my wife. That's insane. What did you tell her? Well, I said no at first. Then she went on a date with some guy, and it drove me crazy, so I gave in. Fear of loss. It has motivated many weak people to make commitments they shouldn't have. So you stopped sleeping with your wife? I ask. If I was Adam, that would be easy to do. He chuckles cruelly. But my wife and I have a decent sex life. I struggle to get my head around what he's saying. So let me see if I understand this. You're cheating on your wife with your affair partner, and now you're also cheating on your affair partner with your wife. Welcome to my life, he replies. That evening, I meet my friend Melanie for dinner. I've known her longer than anyone I've dated. She's been with me through it all, giving me the hard truth after every breakup, just as I've given her advice every time a man she likes gets flaky, the moment a relationship appears on the horizon of their casual dating. Neil, she exclaims when I tell her about San Francisco, you can't go on like this. Don't you want to get married and have children? Yes, more than anything. I just don't want to end up like my parents. I want to find someone who adds to my life rather than limits it. I know someone like that, she says, brushing her hair out of her face. She has a long black mane that cascades halfway down a frame so thin that an enthusiastic hug could snap it in two. "Who?" I ask excitedly, hoping she knows someone perfect to set me up with. And she answers with the one word I'm not ready to hear. "Ingrid." I sigh and mutter something that sounds like, "I know." "She was so perfect for you, Neil." Melanie draws out the end of the sentence like a little girl whining for a puppy. "She's the only girlfriend of yours I met who loved you for you. I'm sure if you just showed her you could commit, she'd come back." "That's the problem," I reply. "We have two very different definitions of commitment." I think about San Francisco and wonder what my relationship with Ingrid would be like if I could hold on to the lessons I learned about love. If there's anyone in the world I'd want to have a child with, it's Ingrid. I flash back to watching the affection and tenderness she showed her shelter dog, Hercules, and I think about how huge her heart is, how playful her spirit is, how great a mother she'd be. If only she'd been willing to budge just a little bit on the monogamy issue. Or maybe Ingrid was right to stand her ground, because right now, I feel like her prediction has come true. I am dying in the wild. "You're sending the universe mixed messages," Melanie lectures. "You keep saying you want a family, but you're surrounding yourself with people you could never have one with. Can't you just let go of the whole non-monogamy thing? For Ingrid." Letting go would make my life so much easier. Maybe this whole thing was a bad idea. "Part of me really wants to," I tell her. "But if I tried to go back to Ingrid now, and it actually worked out, I'd always wonder, what if? What if I quit too soon, just before finding someone as open as Nicole or Sage? What if I found a non-monogamous version of Ingrid? What if there's a stone I left unturned, and it's the right stone? And most terrifying of all, what if I return out of fear and failure, but not love and commitment? What if, what if, what if? It's the ambivalence mating call." "You're going to lose her, Neil. A girl like that doesn't stay single for long." Melanie excuses herself to go to the bathroom. When she returns a few minutes later, she looks distraught. "You're too late," she says, holding up her phone. "I just checked Ingrid's profile." "What do you mean?" A cold sweat prickles through my skin. "I hate to say it, but it looks like she has a boyfriend now." She shows me a picture of a shirtless guy holding Hercules. He's a cross between James Dean and Thor, with hard ripples in places I never knew could grow muscles. In comparison to him, I look as appealing as the Hunchback of Notre Dame. That's not being self-deprecating. It's just a fact. Suddenly, I feel profoundly alone. Not until this moment do I realize that I'd been assuming, so vainly, selfishly, and irrationally, that Ingrid was waiting for me, or there would be some way to return to the relationship if things didn't work out. Whoever this super stud is, I hope that he's worthy of her heart, that he doesn't have doubts, that his skin doesn't crawl when she dotes on him, that he doesn't text random women or jerk off to Pornhub at the slightest provocation, and that he loves Hercules instead of seeing him as a symbol of the hypocrisy of monogamy. I'm sure Ingrid looks back on our relationship as one long mistake. I look at Melanie sitting across from me, trying to figure out what to say to make me feel better, and I fight back the sadness, the fear, the emptiness. It wasn't the right relationship for me, I console myself. It was unhealthy. Love addict and love avoidant. Textbook dysfunction. "Well, I guess that settles it then," I tell Melanie with a smile as convincing as my mom's. "There's no going back. It doesn't matter what it takes or what I have to do anymore. I'm going to find a relationship style that works for me, even if it kills me. And as it turns out, it almost does.
Stage 4. What is my species? Listen, friend, said one of them to the duckling. Not far from here is another moor, in which there are some pretty wild geese, all unmarried. It is a chance for you to get a wife. You may be lucky, ugly as you are. Hans Christian Andersen, The Ugly Duckling. A wise polyamorist once told him, date your own species, Neil. But what is my species, he wondered. He was alone in life. He had just returned from San Francisco, where he had discovered that being a fulcrum was not his species. But he had learned a lot, and he had an idea. He visited the most successful commune in the country, and he stayed there a week, talking to everyone. Some members had been there for over 40 years. Our philosophy is that life is perfect, and I am perfect, said Ilana. When you live here, you don't ever have to do anything you don't want to do, said Colin. They called their community, quote, an experiment in pleasurable group living. And the living seemed pleasurable there. So he wrote his own manifesto on group relationships, and he moved into the treehouse that he had looked at with Rick a long time ago. Nicole and James joined him there. His friends Lawrence and Leah from the polyamory meetup moved in. So did his friend Violet and her new lover Angela, and three others. Everyone was in some type of open relationship. In the mornings, they did yoga and Tai Chi. In the afternoons, they met with teachers to learn intimacy, sensuality, and a powerful method of relating to one another called nonviolent communication. And in the evenings, they played. Life was pleasurable. But Pepper warned him, group relationships of more than four people rarely work. You have an exploding complexity problem. Pepper was right. One afternoon, a housemate's jealous boyfriend had a psychotic break with reality and almost killed him with an axe. Unfortunately, his assailant had missed the point of the nonviolent communication lessons. When it was all over, he looked at what he had made, and it was better than the San Francisco house. But even with the assailant and his girlfriend gone, living in the commune was a full-time job. It took a lot of work, communication, organization, and patience. This was not his species. He was alone again. But he had an idea. I should step into a relationship that already exists rather than trying to create my own, he said. This way, I don't have to worry about making it work. It'll already be working. He suggested that Violet and her lover Angela stay with him for a little longer. They did everything and went everywhere together. And then they went to bed together. They became a poly triad. And it was nice, because he wasn't the fulcrum. Violet was, so there was no competition. Pepper called it a threesome vacation and said it would never work in the long run. Pepper was right. Angela was just enjoying herself between serious relationships. And Violet, well, she had a small drinking problem. When it was all over, he looked at what he had made, and it was better than the commune. But it was more fun than it was real. This was not his species. He was alone again. But he had an idea. He went to dinner with a successful bachelor friend. Think of the woman you've had the wildest sex with, his friend said. He did. Now, think about the woman you've had the best relationship with, his friend said. He did. They're not the same person, am I right? His friend said. His friend was right. Your problem is that you still think of love and sex as things that have to go together, his friend said. You need to separate them. Start a family with a good platonic friend who's your own age and keep sleeping with whoever you want. His friend had an interesting point. It's like having a divorce, but without the marriage, his friend concluded. He asked his lady friends if they were interested. He visited websites for women seeking sperm donors. And he soon found someone special. I am a healthy, happy, successful professional woman who recently woke up one day and yelled, "I forgot to have children," she wrote to him. Now I find myself with the very real possibility that I might not find my soulmate, yet refusing to give up on the great gift of motherhood. He met her for dinner. "I'm an engineer, but I don't want my child to be all left brain," she said. "And you're a writer and right brain, so this is perfect." "You have brown eyes," she continued. "So do I. I'd prefer blue eyes, but it's not a deal breaker." She went through nearly every aspect of his appearance and personality, remarking on which ones she wanted the baby to have and which ones she didn't. This is a little weird, he thought. But Pepper said that co-parenting arrangements can be very successful and that this relationship could actually work. Pepper was right. He looked over what he was about to make, and unlike the triad, this was very real. But he couldn't go through with it. He had learned too much about trauma to be comfortable bringing a child into the world out of desperation rather than love. This was not his species. He was alone again, and he had no more ideas. He looked over the last few months of his life. He had taken three women he barely knew and tried to start a harem with them. He had taken nine random people, put them in a house, encouraged them to be together at all times, and expected them to get along perfectly. He had taken a functional alcoholic and her love-addicted friend, and expected them to form a stable triad. And he had taken a woman who was trying to customize a child as if she were ordering it from a Bilderberger restaurant, and expected her to be a great mother. That's when he saw that he hadn't been in any real relationship since leaving Ingrid. He'd just been creating controlled experiments, and they never had a chance of working. Why was he in such a hurry? Perhaps his biological alarm clock was ringing so loudly it was drowning out his common sense. You can't force a relationship to happen, he finally understood. You just have to make a space in your heart for one, then let go of all expectations, agendas, and control. And that's when he found his species.
Malibu, California.
How are things going?
Not like I planned.
This was supposed to be a period of fun and living decadently, not a period of pain. I think the thing that you want to get through sex, you're not getting.
Everything was fun when I was just having sex. It's when I started trying to have relationships that things got bad.
So are you finding that these relationships aren't any better than monogamous ones, or do you just think you chose the wrong ones?
The truth is that I haven't been going about this right.
And why is that?
I've just been collecting people who are open to these ideas, getting them together, and struggling to make it work. And it turns into a bad reality show every time.
It always does. If you keep chasing after fantasies, you're going to spend the rest of your life having short-term sex with multiple damaged people and passing on the idea of any deep, intimate connection or family.
You seem to have the thesis that only a damaged woman would want casual sex or an open relationship. But the world is changing.
All I'm going off of is what you've been telling me. Nothing is right or wrong. You're just not any happier.
But I'm getting closer. I've seen so many options and so many people making these lifestyles work for them, and I'm finally getting my footing in this world.
Do you remember that when you started this, you were upset about rules and relationships?
Yes.
Are you aware, then, that in every one of these relationships, you've been making rules for them.
Have I? I guess I have.
So maybe your problem isn't actually rules. You love them, as long as you're making them.
Fuck, you're right.
So may I make a suggestion?
Sure.
Have the next relationship with your heart, not your head.
Actually, I did recently meet someone I have a real heart connection with.
Great. Try not to ruin her life. Stage 5. Adventure. On our life together, I want you to understand that I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all times the confinement of even an attractive cage. Amelia Earhart, letter to her fiancé.
Chapter 41. This is how it goes. We wake up together. Sometimes there's another woman under the covers with us. Sometimes there isn't. She cooks breakfast. I make smoothies. And we all feast in bed. Once we're alone, she and I make love again. It is better, stronger, and more connected than it was with our play partner there. Multiples are for adventure, but one-on-one is for connection. We shower, sometimes together, sometimes not. I spend the day writing. She goes to trapeze school or acting class or works on her online business. There's always something she's excited about doing. From one week to another, it's not usually the same thing. Her life passion is simply passion. When the sun sets, we head to dinner. She drives, I DJ. Some nights, we have dinner for two. Other nights, we meet friends. Those friends usually include a few women we've met together. If we're in the mood for an adventure, we adjourn to a bar or club. Afterward, we bring as many women back to the treehouse as we can. When clothes start coming off, whoever is not into it leaves. Oddly, they usually apologize for not participating as they depart, as if it's a moral failing of theirs, and they promise to be more fun next time. Sometimes they return, sometimes they don't. If we choose to have a quiet night after dinner instead, we return home, we watch a movie, we fuck, and we talk about the future, not always in that order. She's so quickly become a part of my life that sometimes it feels like a dream. Everything I enjoy, sex, music, surfing, reading, writing, learning, traveling, she now enjoys with me. And everything I don't enjoy, cooking, driving in LA traffic, transcribing my Rolling Stone interviews, she started doing for me. Sometimes she seems too perfect, as if she's been spawned by some sort of non-monogamous, weird science-type experiment. I'm fairly certain she had a life before we met, but I can't seem to remember what it was. I can barely remember what mine was. She hasn't been back to her home in a month. It may not even exist anymore. I recall asking Lorraine in rehab what was wrong with a single man enjoying his intensity, but I never imagined that two people could be enjoying that intensity together. You know, I tell her one night, I've spent months trying to figure out what kind of relationship is natural to me, whether it's monogamy or polyamory or a group relationship or whatever, but I think I realized what I like. This, she replies joyfully, an adventure relationship? I think that's what I was looking for when we first met, not defining it as monogamy or polyamory or swinging, but just having fun together without having to be part of some stupid social scene. I appear to have found my species, not to mention the heart connection I told Rick about. And so, one of my first dates in this world becomes my last. Sage from Bliss. Chapter 42. It began while I was in the triad. Sage found my email address online, contacted me to say she'd be in Los Angeles, and left me her phone number. Of all the women I'd met since breaking up with Ingrid, she was the only one who shared most of my values, who I regretted blowing it with, and who, though admittedly it may have had something to do with the ecstasy, I could imagine a long future with. I met Sage for dinner a few weeks later. "What happened at Bliss?" I immediately asked. "I thought you were miserable." "I thought you were," she replied. "I kept thinking I was ruining the vibe because I wasn't as high as you guys. You were all having fun, and I just kept getting more tired and irritable." It was a lesson in projection. We hadn't truly seen each other that night, just reflections of the stories we were telling ourselves. It's hard to recall what else we discussed as we ate, because the hours flew by breathlessly. Not only could we not stop talking, we couldn't stop looking, laughing, lusting. With her metallic red hair, her charismatic self-assurance, and her "I just drank 5 energy drinks, but I only have eyes for you" personality, she sparked like a human Tesla coil. That first date ended in a foursome with my old friend and commune mate Leah and a heavily tattooed ex-girlfriend of Sage's named Winter. I watched as Sage attacked Winter, eating her out, fingering her, spanking her, then flipping her over and fingering her from behind, and I thought, I've met my match. Soon Sage, Leah, and Winter started going down on me, passing it, fighting over it, sharing it, talking dirty. When Winter artfully wrapped her necklace around it, playing with the tension, I couldn't hold out anymore. As they licked me and each other clean, I thought, this is the greatest experience of my life. All that time and money wasted on sex addiction therapy, all that drama and misery in San Francisco, even the attempted murder at the Love Commune, every disaster, misstep, and tragedy. It was all worth it for these few minutes. I often reflect on Rick's warning that on their deathbeds, people always think about love and family. But I believe I will also be thinking about this moment. We are sexual beings. It was my sexual zenith. I'd like to say that there was some negative outcome or consequence, that this was the nadir of my addiction, that it was fundamentally flawed because there was no true intimacy and we didn't wait 17 dates before touching, but it wasn't. There were no negative consequences. Or so I thought. People are such good liars, they even fool themselves sometimes. Just before sunrise, as Sage and I made love once again, Leah and Winter slipped out to leave us alone. A few hours later, Lawrence texted, "Sounds like a great time last night. I'm very happy you and Leah finally had a chance to connect." I thought carefully of the right response that would show appreciation without either being awkward or crude. So I wrote, "It was really a great experience on a number of levels, including that it was part of a good friendship with both of you." Evidently, it was the right answer, because he responded, "That's exactly what I was thinking. Poignant. I really appreciate our friendship." He is the definition of compersion. Of all my sexual experiences since Ingrid, this was the only one that was wholly enjoyable, before, during, and after. Perhaps that's because, outside of an irrepressible hope that Sage would somehow still be interested in me, I had no relationship agenda. In fact, it was Sage who instigated the foursome that night. In the weeks that follow, my closets and drawers fill with Sage's clothes, and her room in Brooklyn empties. There was a missing piece in my life, for romance, for passion, for companionship, for understanding, for connection, for freedom within a partnership, and Sage somehow senses it and molds herself right into that shape. Even needs I didn't know I had or would enjoy, she begins filling. Meanwhile, our adventures pile up. We do things I haven't even seen in porn clips, things that made me want to do books with rock bands just so I could live vicariously through them, things I didn't know were physically or geometrically possible. I never would have imagined that my sex life would become better, wilder, and more varied in a relationship than it was at the peak of my singledom. Finally, after everyone said it was impossible, I'm having my cake and eating it too. Even Pepper gives the relationship a positive prognosis. It's more common, and it's sustainable, he says, because everything you're doing with other people is short-term and transient. Yet, most incredibly of all, the adventures are only a supplement to what appears to be a growing bond between Sage and me. In fact, perhaps the least healthy part of the relationship isn't the sex, but the fact that we're never apart. For the first time since breaking up with Ingrid, it feels legitimately possible to live happily and non-monogamously ever after. Chapter 43. However, as we hit the 3-month mark, that inevitable point when relationships begin to get real, I notice a change in Sage's behavior. It's so subtle at first, it wouldn't hold up in a court of law as an actual change. But I see it in the way she looks at me. It seems not loving anymore, but like someone trying to play the part of loving. At first, I wonder if it's just in my imagination, stemming from a sense of unworthiness, or the love avoidant in me trying to sabotage the relationship. But then one day, when we return from a trip to New York, she walks into the house and opens the refrigerator. Something has gone putrid and is rotting. As she smells it, fire truck and ambulance sirens ring shrilly from the street outside. She screams. It comes out of nowhere, a room-shaking, from-the-soul shriek. It's not directed at the sirens, the refrigerator, me, or anything specific, but at the universe. Her voice drowns out the noise, the smell, my thoughts. "What's wrong?" I ask as she sits on the couch afterward, sobbing. She wipes her nose. She looks up at me with those loving but not loving eyes. She says, "I've been reading my diary, and I miss me." "What do you mean?" "I don't know exactly. I guess sometimes I miss my wild days, when I was single and could just do whatever I wanted." Only too late do I realize why things have felt off lately. She cooks, she drives, she transcribes my interviews, she brings in a constant parade of women. I have my freedom, a caked-out relationship completely on my terms and on my turf. And what does she really have? Just me. She's been so busy taking care of my needs, she's completely neglected hers. In fact, I don't even know what her needs are. I thought we were being wild, but I guess that to her, I was just being predictable, male, and selfish, and taking her for granted. So I tell Sage what I wish Ingrid had said to me. "Why don't you be free then? We should both be able to do whatever we want. Why should the fact that we're dating keep you from that?" And that's how our relationship becomes a truly open one. It will lead to more pain than I could possibly imagine.
Stage 6. Open. Yoda. The fear of loss is a path to the dark side. Attachment leads to jealousy. The shadow of greed, that is. Anakin Skywalker. What must I do, Master Yoda? Yoda. Train yourself to let go of everything you fear to lose. Star Wars, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, directed by George Lucas.
Chapter 44. I have done it all. Harems, communes, swinging, pujas, morsums. And yet I haven't. Since leaving the cage of monogamy, I've searched for sexual freedom, and on a few occasions, perhaps even found it. Yet not once have I given my partner comparable freedom. Though I haven't kept anyone shackled to me by rules, promises, and fears, the situation never arose on its own. And on some level, I've been grateful for that. But reality has caught up with me and delivered the news that freedom is not just for parties of one. You can have your cake and you can eat it, but one day you're going to have to share it too. Sage and I are at a fancy tapas restaurant in Los Angeles with my former commune mates Lawrence and Leah, as well as three of Sage's friends from her weekly acting class. The hostess leads us to a large circular table, the kind Corey Feldman would put in a hotel room. I sit next to Leah and Lawrence. Two guys from Sage's class flank my other side. Sage arrives at the table last, humming happily to herself. She's wearing white shorts and a tight black baby tee with sleeves that stop just below her shoulders. She doesn't just walk to the table, she swaggers. She looks for a seat beside me and seems disappointed when she doesn't find one. So instead, she sits across from me, next to the third person from her class. He's over 6 feet tall, with wavy black hair and the whitest teeth I've ever seen. He introduces himself as Donald. I've never met anyone named Donald before, most likely because any reasonable person would shorten it to Don, unless he was a small-town theater snob determined to move to Hollywood to make it as an actor. This thought forms in my mind with all its incipient hostility before I can stop it. And this is probably because as soon as he's finished introducing himself to me, Donald's arm is on the back of Sage's chair, and they're engaged in deep conversation. I try to see my judgment for what it is, jealousy, insecurity, envy, and let it go. Sage has seen at least 20 different women with their tongues in my mouth since we started dating, so the least I can do is let her enjoy Donald's very sincere attention. So, what made you decide to be in an open relationship? I ask Lawrence and Leah, hoping to get some tips and stay distracted. I'd been in a monogamous marriage before, and it didn't really work for me, Lawrence replies. The whole time we were together, I was faithful, but I felt physical pain in my body from not having all that juice and excitement and connection in my life. When I came out of that, I decided I wouldn't ever do that again. I remember you were really upfront from day one that you were non-monogamous, Leah says. There was no moment where I thought, maybe I can persuade him to be monogamous with me. You made it clear, it's either this or we can't see each other. And I felt enough for you that I decided to give it a try. From the corner of my eye, I see Donald's arm. It's no longer on the back of Sage's chair. It's now resting on her shoulder. Do you ever feel jealous with Lawrence? I ask Leah. I wouldn't describe it as being jealous, but definitely some insecurity and paranoia. A waiter reaches over the table to set our food down, scoping out Sage in the process. Maybe he'll get her number later. Suddenly, everyone's my rival. But at one point, Leah continues, something clicked inside me, and I started seeing Lawrence as a genuine person who has my best interest in mind. And I realized that most of the insecurity came from my own childhood fear of being abandoned. So maybe I'm feeling jealousy because I'm not secure in the relationship right now. I'm worried that Sage opened it up because I wasn't enough, because she was bored by the things that I've been enjoying. Or even worse, because she was so attracted to Donald. It's been a week since that decision, and neither of us has been with anyone else. All we've done is discuss our values around being open. I told her that honesty is important to me, and we need to always share our reality with each other. She told me that respect is important to her, and she needs to always be put first. So we decided to build our open relationship on a foundation of honesty, freedom, and respect. It's exactly what I've always wanted. And what I like most about it is that, as Pepper advised, there are no rules, just intents. As I watch her with Donald, though, I become painfully aware of the positive side of rules. They provide clear, fixed boundaries that keep us feeling safe. Did you like the jicama-wrapped guacamole? I ask Sage across the table, trying to force a connection. But she doesn't hear me. It may be because her other two friends from acting class are engaged in a loud, silly improv game with each other. So I repeat the question, but to no avail. Now I feel ignored. Something I can't control is going on with my ego. I try to focus on what Lawrence is saying. If she's out, and she says she's met a guy and wants to explore it, I say, "You're an adult. You don't need my permission." The frame we have is that we're both adults, and we trust each other's judgment. Otherwise, we wouldn't be together. I suppose I just need to trust Sage's judgment. But what if she judges him as more compatible with her than I am? Do I trust that? I guess I'd have to. Okay, I ask Lawrence. So if I'm feeling jealousy right now, what do I do? In my imagination, I never thought I'd be upset if Sage wanted to spend the night with another guy, as long as I knew about it. But in reality, it's a completely different experience. And this is just a man with his arm around her. Suddenly, I have a little more empathy for the guy in the commune who tried to murder me. If you're feeling insecurity or jealousy, that's for you to manage, Lawrence answers. It's not her job to manage your discomfort, unless she's doing something that's disrespectful or hurtful. One tool I've used is to understand that even if Leah deeply loves another person, it can only be additive to our relationship. In what way? Think of it like this. You have a love muscle. And if you work it out more, it increases your capacity to love. And you can bring that energy and quality back to your relationship. The alternative to that would be my marriage, where I shut down my capacity to love and feel and have sex in order to stay monogamous. Maybe I just have to eliminate my scarcity mentality about love, which is telling me right now that Sage has only so much to give and could run out. Lawrence's point of view makes much more sense. Perhaps, on some level, the demand for exclusive love is an immature demand, the desire of the needy child who hungered to be the sole object of its parents' attention, affection, and care. So, I confirm with Lawrence, if she's happy, it's not like she's going to go home and be sad because she got all the happiness out of her system. Right, he replies. After being in the same situation 50 or 100 times, pretty soon you won't be so scared or overwhelmed. You'll recognize the sensation as something that's going to pass. In my worst moments, I think of tying myself to the mast so I don't get sucked in by the sirens of jealousy and dashed against the rocks. There's nothing good that comes of jealousy. If someone's going to leave you, they're going to do it whether or not you're jealous. In fact, they're much more likely to do it if you are jealous. It makes a lot of sense, so I try to lash myself to the mast and stay focused on Lawrence and Leah. When dessert comes, however, I can't contain myself any longer. I look over at Sage and squeak, "How do you like the flan?" And she completely ignores me again, like I'm invisible, or more likely, not speaking loudly enough. Donald's leaning in so close, their faces are almost touching. "What do you do if Leah sleeps with a guy who you think is a douchebag?" I ask Lawrence. "If he's a douchebag," Lawrence replies, "either there's something else she's getting from him, or it's for her to figure out. I don't have to fuck him, so it's not my problem." I imagine walking on the beach alone tomorrow morning, while Sage is in bed with Donald and two women she's brought home for them to share. A queasy feeling spreads through my chest, knees, fingers, toes, eyeballs. I thought I'd learned and been through enough by this point to control myself better. But this is actually the first time I've had to walk the path of uncomfortable jealousy that Shama Helena told me about and that the women in the San Francisco house went through with me. When we finally get up to leave, I dash to Sage and ask her, "Did you have a good dinner?" "Yeah, it was great," she smiles. "I just want to make sure you are comfortable with Donald." I'm hoping she'll tell me that she was uncomfortable and just being polite, but she doesn't. "Yeah, I enjoyed talking to him. We've never really had the chance to connect in class." "Okay, good." Not good. As we reach the door, she stops and stands with one knee bent forward, which has the enticing effect of creating a nearly perfect triangle between her legs. I walk out to see if she'll follow me, but she doesn't. She just waits near the exit for Donald, posing like a water fountain nymph. And it hits me in the stomach like a baseball bat. It feels like she's choosing him over me. I pause on the stairs between the restaurant and the valet stand to see if she'll stop on her way out to join me. And as with every secret test a person gives someone they care about, she fails it. When Sage leaves with Donald, she walks right past me and they head to the valet together. And I could swear a smile flickers across his face. I broke up with Ingrid precisely because I believed so much in romantic freedom. Because I swore by the principle that one person should not own another's body. Because I was so firmly convinced that possessiveness was a fungus rotting relationships. So why, I wonder, as Sage mercifully enters the passenger seat of my car to return to the treehouse, is it eating me up so much inside now that I've finally reached the promised land of my ideal free relationship? Chapter 45. 3 days later, Sage tells me she's flying to Mexico for a long weekend with Donald and a friend of his with an equally unshortened name, Jonathan. And there's nothing I can do to protest. I've already given her permission. In a moment of fear and paranoia, I wonder if the offer was on the table before we opened up the relationship. But rather than dwell on doubts, I focus on the opportunity. This is my chance to truly let go of possession and jealousy, to allow someone I'm with to have fun, even if it doesn't include me. Once again, it's exactly what I asked for, and already, it's not what I expected. Clearly, I was supposed to be the one going to Mexico with two actresses. I once dated a woman who always said she wanted to marry someone rich. She ended up marrying a flat, broke musician. His name was Rich. The universe listens, and it gives you not just what you want, but what you deserve. It's the forager's karmic law. "When's the trip?" I ask Sage. We are in the kitchen, where she's not just cooking breakfast, she's performing it, putting on a show whenever she reaches for a glass in a high kitchen cabinet or cracks open an egg. She's wearing black framed glasses and a blue hoodie that's been washed to maximum softness and unzipped to show the handles of her collarbone. I look at her with respect, lust, gratitude, fear. She's gotten inside me, to a deep place, where my cultural, genetic, and developmental programming resides, and plugged herself in. "Tomorrow," she says and quickly adds, "it's just for 3 days." And now I worry she's about to unplug herself. I feel a pang in my heart. It's too soon. I don't have time to mentally prepare for this. "Did they buy your ticket for you?" I ask. Jealousy is all over my voice like a coat of spray paint. I need to shut up. "Yes," she replies, "but I told them I won't sleep with them."